You may be owed some money. After 911 and 411, call 541. That's 727-541-1741. Call Gulfstream Motorsports for a diminished value report. Due to my 28 years experience in the auto salvage business, I'm very good with wrecks. So if your car's been involved in a wreck, call me for a diminished value report. Call 727-541-1741. You may be owed some money for the lost value of your repaired vehicle. And visit us at GulfstreamMotorsports.com.
Looking for car shows? Then look no further than flacarshows.com. On your computer or on your mobile device, flacarshows.com is a comprehensive list of automotive events, plus videos and news articles. Whether you're looking for car shows, cruise-ins, meetups, automotive festivals, cars and coffees, or anything else relating to an internal combustion engine, then this is a site for you. Check it out online or on your phone at flacarshows.com.
Brilliant day dawns for Germany's great international race at the Nürburgring. 17 giants roar away, but so hot is the pace and so difficult the course that out of those 17, only 7 are destined to finish. And for its special Irish edition, Pathé Gazette presents a superb sound picture of one of the year's greatest motor races. On so important an occasion, the famous old Zeppelin comes out of her hangar and zooms over the course. And we take to the air, too, to look down on this mighty struggle of men and machines. Nears its finish, all eyes are on Rudolf Caracciola, who has already won the trophy 5 times before and looks like hitting the bull again. Chola in his mighty Mercedes number 12 takes the lead, and the man who has already won the German championship 5 times makes it 6. In 1939 again, Rudolf Caracciola is winner of the big prize and German champion.
And now for all you music lovers, it's time for your traffic report. There's a 6... Oh. What is it, Scoob? Can't you see I'm broadcasting here? Pile up on the tri-level, got you backed up all the way to the off-ramp. So, if you're traveling this morning, try to give yourself an extra day or two, folks. Hang on, folks. I've just been handed this important bulletin. Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our regularly scheduled program to bring you this special report. Like live, as it happens.
This is Bill Warner of the Amelia Island Concord Delegates, and you are listening to Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
Okay, listeners, welcome. You're tuned in to Nostalgic Radio and Cars. I'm your show host, Robert. Run your computers in Google Tan Talk 1340.com, and you can see us, actually me, live here in the studios in downtown Clearwater. Don't forget to check out our website, GulfstreamMotorsports.com, where you can find out all about us at NostalgicRadioandCars.com. That's it, yeah. Good evening, Bobby. How are you doing?
Pretty good. How about you?
You're driving the studio again. Very good, very good, very good. Anyway, all right, so we got an exciting show for you tonight. We got part two with Miles Collier of the Revs Institute down here in Naples. But I'm going to talk a little bit about Monterey Collector Car Week, which is coming up next week. Actually, it's kind of started now. I mean, unofficially, you know, everybody's kind of gathering out there right now. Number of things going on. Obviously, the big thing is the Rolex Motorsport Reunion, which is all the vintage cars. There's usually a few hundred cars, 200-300 cars that show up for that. And honestly, you know, the gate is somewhere around 50,000 people show up for that event over a couple of days, and or more, actually. And but I know I've been there before when the one-day attendance, actually, I think that was a number of years ago when they had the Porsche, what was it called? Porsche Rennsport. 63,000 people were there that day. Or for that weekend, and that was a ton of people. It was all Porsche, which is pretty cool. Anyway, so the Rolex reunion. Now, it's really cool because you really get to see it's history in motion. Now, we'll be talking about vintage race cars here in a little bit when Miles comes on the show. And so that ought to be pretty interesting because he's got some firsthand experience. And then, of course, the Revs Institute, which is has some amazing cars. And, of course, we just played that little clip from the 1939 German Grand Prix. With, and I cannot pronounce his name right, but Carocciola, I think was his name. He was the he was actually German with an Italian name, of all things. But he was born in Prussia at the time, so that was kind of like, you know, that part of Germany, northern Germany. So there was, you know, Europeans are Europeans. Anyway, but he was driving for Mercedes, and he won the Grand Prix. Actually, he won countless races with that very same car in 1938, and then again in 1939, and then, of course, you know, winning the Nürburgring Grand Prix. And, of course, or the German Grand Prix, the Nürburgring. But that was just before the war, so that was the last race for a number of years until after the war. But nonetheless, that very car is at the Revs Institute right now. So that's pretty amazing. It's a W154. I think that's the numerical designation. If you're familiar with Mercedes-Benzes, you know, you probably see S500, S380, S280, S600, and things like that. Okay, so those cars have, that's the engine, the cars, and then those cars actually, like for example, a 280 SL Mercedes could have either a W113 designation, which is the body code, or a W107, which is a later one. And W190 something is the newer ones that they have out now, and so on and so on. A sedan is usually like a 116, a 123 car, one 26 car, or a 108 car, or a 109 car, depending on which one it is, you know. So, and it would take me a whole story, just a whole radio show alone, just to break all that stuff down. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you got your Ford. America, we were different. You know, we just said, you got a Mustang. Although, if I remember correctly, the numerical designation for the Mustang, the original Mustang, was T5, if I remember correctly, somewhere in the history there. And when the car went to, when the Mustang, Ford Mustang went to Europe and competed over there, or when they were sold over there, they could not use the name Mustang because there was some company in either one of the Eastern Bloc countries that had the naming rights to Mustang. And they wanted a ton of money because Ford wanted it, and Ford says, yeah, that's okay. We'll just change the name to the T5. So if you see a Euro export car in Germany, a Mustang, it's going to have, actually, and I've seen this because I lived over there when I was a kid, it actually has a T5 badge on it. You can Google it if you want to fact check me. Anyway, so Monterey Collector Car Week is commencing as of this weekend, so kind of like one of the kickoff events is Monterey Historics, or the Rolex Monterey Reunion, and then which is at the Laguna Seca Racetrack, which is one of my favorite tracks. I've never driven it, but I've ridden in it plenty of times, and it's pretty exciting, as well as Sonoma Raceway, which is the old Sears Point, which I think they call Sonoma again now, but it was Sears Point back in the day, which is also one of my other favorite tracks, and that's up closer to where I grew up in Northern California. Anyway, so...
Is it WeatherTech now?
No. Laguna Seca's WeatherTech. Yeah, I know whenever I had everybody up from WeatherTech, I always goof that up, and I forget to say, because, you know, us old schoolers just call the tracks by they are. You know, it's like the Tampa Bay Stadium... Whose name's hanging on the side of it? I don't
even
know.
James, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I would say the Tampa Bay Stadium, this Tampa Stadium, but, you know, if you want to be politically correct or...
No, correct, advertisingly correct.
Advertisingly correct, you would say the Raymond James thingy. Just like, what's the hockey arena over there? It's called...
Amalie.
Okay, so Amalie. Now, here's a funny thing about advertising.
Yep, it's Sonoma.
It's Sonoma?
Yep.
Okay. So anyway... Amalie Arena. Now, most people probably don't know what Amalie is, but Amalie is actually oil. It's an oil company. It's a company in Tampa that produces oil, and they have a whole Wolf's Head's another one of theirs, and a couple other ones. I think Grease Lightning's another thing that they do. So they private label a whole bunch of stuff, but they're actually a oil processing plant. Of course, they're right there over at the port, and they bring all this, the raw materials in, and they process it. And then if you're an XYZ company and you want a batch of oil with your name on it, Bob's Oil, let's say Bob's, my own oil, Bob's Oil, and Nostalgic Autos Oil, or Nostalgic Radio Cars Oil, or whatever you want to call it, basically I go to them and say, hey, look, I want you to mix a little of this and a little of that and post more of this, and, you know, kind of makes me like my little witch's brew, so to speak. And then poof, put it in a nice little, package it nice in a little jug, so a little bottle, and then I want to distribute it to, AutoZone and O'Reilly's and Walmart and everybody like that, and put it online, and then I'll have my, very own, my old Bob's Oil. It's really good stuff. You got to try it. And I just got an idea there. So anyway. I mean, it's a simple name. If you stop and think about it, it's kind of like a few weeks ago or months or so ago, we had Gene Teston on and the other guy.
Oh, yeah.
And we're talking about Garage One, well, which is basically a automotive conditioning kind of car
line of detail products.
Detail product, exactly. And so, and there's a company that basically you it's not like something you whip up and you cook up in your kitchen. You basically go to a distributor. Or a someone like that, or a
you find a chemist, and
whip up your own little witch's brew, and then you market, you come up with a name, and you market it, and off you go. You know, it either turns very successful or it doesn't. But you know, everybody's getting to that. I mean, Bear Jackson's got their car detail stuff. Jay has his, obviously. You know, so anyways, all right. So let me get down to Monterey Collector Car Week, and again, if you've never been there. And it's gotten outrageously expensive, and but it's the show of shows. I mean, if you, it's kind of like Ferruccio Lamborghini said, if you want to be somebody, you drive a Ferrari. If you are somebody, you drive a Lamborghini. Well, it's kind of like if you are somebody, you might go to the Detroit Concourse, but if you are somebody, you go to Monterey. How about that? Is that kind of a decent analogy? Anyway, so Monterey. All right, so we got, obviously, we got a number of events. You've got the auctions that are there. You've got Mecum's that's there, which has got a ton of cars. You've got almost over 1,000 cars. So a big shout out to my friends over at Mecum. You got Gooding's. Gooding's had a ton of cars over there. I think they've got something like 200 some odd cars going through. Very, very, very exquisite cars. And of course, RM, which is the creme de la creme of auctions, RM Sotheby's. And a big shout out to my friends over there. And they do a very, very, very good job. And they're at the downtown in Monterey at the Portola Inn. And they've got some fascinating cars going through there. Then, of course, you've got Legends of the Autobahn, which is all German cars. It's a big car show. It's open to the public, is what's really cool. You know, then they have our friends over at Grassroots Motorsports. They're in Pacifica, which is a little town nearby there, a little fishing town, so to speak, in the Monterey Peninsula there. And they've got a big event there, and it's a car show thing, and it's free, again, open to the public. It's pretty cool. And you just walk the streets, and the cars are just lined up there. It's pretty neat. And then on Friday, you've got the Porsche Works Reunion, and that is actually open to the public, and it's free, although they hammer you for $50 to park your car. But other than that, you know, I mean, if you got a Porsche, it's no big deal. You know, I mean, sell a couple lug nuts and you got $50. So, or, you know, your center caps, whatever. Anyway, but that's an all-day event. And then, let's see what else. And then you've got the Concorso Italiano, which is on Saturday. And some of the finest Italian cars there and some really, really well-known Italian designers show up there. People from the automobile, the actual industry, if you're over there. A couple of years ago, they had some Ferrari people there. They had Pininfarina people there. They had people from Zagato there. These are the design houses that are actually in Italy. That Bertone, you know, which are names that you're probably familiar with. You know, obviously Lamborghini. And I got a chance to meet Ferruccio Lamborghini's son, which was kind of cool. I got to meet I can't pronounce his name right. And he was the designer of the Pantera. He was there, and we tried to get him on the radio show. Unfortunately, he passed away, but he was living in Italy at the time, and you know, so sometimes there's logistics and stuff involved, but definitely if you, and then of course Sunday is the Pebble Beach Concourse, and it's just absolutely amazing. Again, 250, 300 cars, the finest cars in the world, and they're broadening out a little bit. They're kind of doing what Bill Warner did with Amelia Island. They've got basically, you know, a pre-war car that wins an award and a post-war car, which is the way it should be. They've got motorcycles there. They've got sports cars. There are a lot of sports cars. And, of course, you know, the heavy American classics from the turn of the century to the, you know, the 30s, pre-war cars. So, and our friend Miles Collier from the Revs Institute has a number of the cars on the lawn there. So We're excited for that too, because he'll probably, they may have something there this year. I don't know. We'll find out when we have him on the show here. And on that note, okay, big shout out to all my friends. Big shout out to my buddies up there, my new friend, because I told you guys last week that my computer screwed up. So what's the name of the company up there in
Crystal River Computer.
Yeah, so Noah, if you're listening, big shout out to Noah. He's trying to figure out why my computer crashed or whatever that thing is, and why it whatever did all kinds of weird stuff. And then Craig's probably tuning in tonight, and Craig has like a little hot rod show, and he does that thing, and we'll probably give him a spot on here one of these days, and he can talk a little bit about his little deal, because he's trying to put together car shows, and he's doing T-shirts and all kinds of cool stuff, and he's up there in the Pasco County area. So a big shout out to Craig if he's listening. And outside of that, I think Bobby, we got to turn up the stereo this time, and we're going to play another instrumental song. And this was kind of real popular back in the early 60s. I think it's by The Ventures, right? And is it Let's Go? Is that what we're playing?
Let's Go.
Let's Go. All right. Hey, you're tuning into Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and let's go.
Das ist Jochen Maas, hallo, und Sie hören Nostalgic Radio und Autos. Wunderbar.
Okay, we're back, and you're tuned into Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and it's time to introduce our special guest for the evening, and he's the former chairman and founder of the Revs Institute, right down here, a few miles south of us here in Naples, Florida. I'm delighted to welcome back Miles Collier. Miles, how are you this evening?
I'm well, thank you. It's nice to be back with you.
Thank you. Hey, I was just talking a few minutes ago about Monterey. Monterey's coming up, Collector Car Week. Are you going to be there?
I will be there.
Okay. Are you going to have something really, really cool and interesting on the show field?
Yeah, we'll have two Bentleys. We'll have a 6-liter speed model. We'll have a 3-liter 100-mile-an-hour model, which is a very, very rare 3-liter variant that did just what its name says. And ours is a well-known car because it has Serbico coachwork. Makes it probably the prettiest 3-liter Bentley on the planet. So we're excited to show it.
Interesting. Now, a few years ago, I did a driving tour with our friends up there over in Daytona, in Grassroots Motorsports, you know, Tim and those guys. And one of the guys there, I can't remember his name exactly, but I know he's one of the guys that works with, I think he's with RM now, Porter, Greg Porter, maybe, that was his name?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay. So Greg had a vintage Bentley, and I had the opportunity to ride with him in that car. And it is a handful. It truly is. I mean, people have no idea what driving's like, and I'm leading to something here, what driving was like back in the 30s, turn of the centuries, how complicated these cars are compared to what we have today. And it was, but it was totally fascinating. I wanted to drive the car, but he wouldn't let me, which is okay. You know, I mean, it was, it's not for the weak. You know, the, I mean, you need a little, you need to almost go through a little, like a little learning process to drive that car. Do you get to drive those cars very often? And have you driven those cars? And what are your thoughts on those? And compare them to what we got today.
Well, I get to drive them occasionally. Part of what Revs Institute is that we're basically, for all intents and purposes, an institution.
Mm-hmm.
And as an institution, it's probably not appropriate for me to just drive all the damn cars anytime. So we try to be very cautious and have professionals drive the cars. That having been said, I have driven Bentleys. And they are very much like any car from the 20s or the 30s, which, you know, that's almost 100 years ago now. And as a result, things that are automatically done for you in automobiles today have to be done manually back then, such as setting the timing, setting the mixture, all of those types of things. And if you are particularly lucky in the choice of Bentley model you select, you may find you have a car with center gas. That is, the accelerator pedal is between the clutch and the brake. And of course, all Bentleys of that period do not have synchromesh transmission. They're crash gearboxes, so you have to know how to double clutch.
So I guess where this question is going to kind of go is, you know, they talk about how we have this new innovative stuff that we're incorporating in automobiles. And I would say probably not within the last few years, but let's say probably in the late 90s, early 2000s and stuff. So, for example, let's talk about multi-valve cylinder heads. Let's talk about porcelain-coated engines and components. Let's talk about overhead camshafts. Let's talk about you know, even early fuel injections. Some of this stuff was around 100 years ago. It's just that it was kind of cost prohibitive in a way, and it was really used mostly in racing applications. But today, because of the costs and available and technology, we can produce these things on a larger scale, obviously, and more affordable, and the engines run relatively efficient. So my question to you is if when back in the day when this technology was around, even though it was, you know, in its infancy, so to speak, did the engines really operate on a much more efficient level compared to, let's say, a classic L-head, flathead motor, when you had all this technology, the multi-valves, the overhead camshafts, and things like that?
Well, remember that early high-performance engines, as you say, have been with us a long time. The first double overhead cam four-valve engine in history was built for the 1912 French Grand Prix. And that was in a Peugeot. And that car had a much smaller engine than its competitors did that were L-heads and other types of not as good breathing engines as the Peugeot. And it promptly, you know, walked away from everybody. The power outlet compared to a four-valve twin-cam engine of today, of course, was negligible, had very low compression ratios. Basically, the whole idea of trying to optimize breathing, which the term for that might be brake mean effective pressure, is the way you measure how full the cylinder is filled with the gas air mixture, et cetera, was not good. But nevertheless, the benefits of the twin cam four valve system were apparent even at a 5-to-1 compression ratio and so on. So, you know, the other way to think about it, I guess, is we've always had power throughout the life of historical motor racing right up to the present. What we've not had till fairly recent is grip. That is, the lateral acceleration you get from tires.
Okay, so it's like, I think, I'm not sure if this is a real comment that Carroll Shelby made. He says, horsepower is not the problem, traction's the problem. So does that kind of like go along with what you're just talking about right now?
That's exactly the case.
Okay.
Cars in 1925 had plenty of power. There was no issue with that. The issue was they didn't have any brakes and they didn't have any cornering because they had little tiny narrow hard rubber tires. Nobody understood that stuff, and the suspension systems were crude.
Did aerodynamics play a role in early racing? When was it kind of like implemented? When did they kind of like correlate the two?
Aerodynamics can be thought of as going back almost to the beginning of motoring. Now, not as a common practice, but as individual examples. So we think of the Stanley Steamer woggle bug that ran on Daytona Beach and sadly was crashed, but the numbers that were coming out of that run were, 130, 140 miles an hour, and this is in 19-aught whatever with a steam car, and the thing looked like an upside-down canoe. We think of the 1903 Paris-Madrid race that was called due to the carnage that ensued from that in Bordeaux, and the leading Moors that won that also had an aero body on it. Again, it looked like a boat upside down with four wheels sticking out. So, the idea of aerodynamics and of aero drag was something that was at least perceived of and understood by some people. But the modern understanding of how aero works to produce downforce and how you manage the drag versus downforce trade-off, et cetera, is something that really hasn't happened until well into the 1970s.
A lot of people aren't aware of the fact that Ormond Beach is considered the birthplace of racing here in the United States. So going back to, you talked about the race that took place in France, and from what little bit I read, or from what I've read, I think it was Willie K. Vanderbilt that used to go over there and watch those races and said, we need to bring this type of racing here to the United States. So hence the Vanderbilt Cup, 1905 or 4, somewhere around in that time frame. And then a lot of people don't realize that a lot of the automobile manufacturers, before they were in Detroit, were actually in the New England area. And what they would do is they would bring the cars down to Ormond Beach, and they would really set land speed records or racing speed records on the beach. The thing that I think is kind of interesting is, however true this all is, all history points to that, there's not really a big to-do about it, and there's no real landmark over there in Ormond Beach. Granted, we have Daytona, okay, but Ormond Beach is significant, so elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, I think you said most of it is that in the early days of the automobile, they had various types of competition. One of them was basically to see how fast you could go, and ultimately that turned into, the formal attempt on the land speed record. And one of the things worth noting is that it wasn't until 1903 that an internal combustion engine car held the land speed record. Before that time, every world land speed record holder was either electric or steam. So, tradition of racing on the beach up at Ormond Beach, Daytona, and the Northeast Florida the beaches is something that lasted well into the late 1920s, early 1930s. You had John Cobb coming over from England with cars. You had some domestic attempts. Frank Lockhart driving the U-16 Miller land speed car, the Black Hawk, some really amazing stuff went on there.
Do you, talking about racing now, and you know, we were talking about the engines earlier and the compression ratios, which you said were like 5-1 back in those days. And of course, obviously now we know that compression makes power. And, you know, even in the 70s, 60s and 70s, a lot of cars were, you know, 10, 10.5-1, 12-1, you know, from the factory. And then it went.
You have to remember that they had gasoline. That
exactly.
Had, I'm making this up. An octane rating that was about 30.
Oh wow!
No, don't believe that. I'm just making that up to okay. make my point.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I mean, you know, today, you know, you want 91 octane at the pump. Back in the Sunoco 260 days, you could probably get 101 or something.
Yep.
Racing gases today are we use 106 octane racing gas. In those days, gas chemistry was not understood.
Okay.
And if you think back, it was Kettering with General Motors who came up with the idea of adding tetraethyl lead to gasoline, and that finally got octane numbers up where you could actually build a high compression engine. And as you say, compression makes horsepower. So those early cars, they were running on something that was just a notch up from kerosene, and you couldn't run any compression.
Interesting. Now, what about the use of alcohol? Like, what did the Indy cars run? They ran pretty much alcohol and methanol, or is that what they ran?
Methanol, yep.
So that's highly...
And methanol was used in a number of racing venues.
Okay.
Racing Bugattis back in the 20s. I won't say all of them ran methanol, but a significant number did. And that's one of the reasons why when you run a Type 35 Bugatti today, or Type 51, the typical Bugatti-looking Bugatti, they really have no more radiator capacity than they absolutely can just scrape by on. And they're a hell of a lot happier on methanol than they are on gasoline, because they run cooler. And if you run gasoline, they have a tendency to boil on hill climbs and things like that.
Interesting.
Ran into that problem all the time on the Colorado Grand and the California Millie and those kinds of tours.
Did the cars that ran on methanol, what was it? What were their compressions like? Compression ratios.
Well, you're hitting me with all these trivia questions. I don't know the answer.
Okay.
I would say that by the. When I was talking about 5-1, we're way back in 1912, 1913, and so on. By the time you're in the 1920s, they're probably in the 8-1 or something like that. And then remember, by the 1920s, things like a 91 Miller was running a centrifugal supercharger. So their effective compression ratio, when you added the boost from the centrifugal supercharger, was pretty substantial.
Interesting.
They made 200 horsepower out of 91 cubic inches, which is bad for 1927.
No, that's very good. Well, let me ask you this. Is it true that the supercharger was basically something that was developed for airplanes and then applied to automotive? Is there truth to that?
I believe that's true.
Okay.
That's my understanding, but I wouldn't want to be deposed on that topic.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. Let's jump into this one. You have a background of doing some vintage racing yourself, so racing some vintage cars. Tell us about some of the cars that you raced and when you were racing, when you were fairly active. And I guess that was, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, somewhere around that time?
Yeah, well, in the 1960s, early 70s, I ran a E-Production Porsche Speedster in the Northeast. In SCCA club racing, the regionals and national races, things like that. Did that for 3 years or something like that. And then later on, when I got into collecting historical automobiles, then I started historic car racing. And the car I ran the most was a ex-Porsche Works 914/6 GT. And I also had a 911R, and my friend Bruce Jennings, probably heard of that
name. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
My friend Bruce Jennings used to drive the 911R, and I'd drive the 914/6, and we'd go to vintage races together. That was a good time.
Was the 914 GT, wasn't one of the steel roof cars, was it?
not a steel roof, but the vinyl roof that you think of as being removable from a 914-6 road car is permanently bolted to the car.
Okay.
914-6 GT.
So
it still has the leatherette, crinkled.
Yeah, I think
vinyl cover on it.
Yeah, I think I'm confusing it with the 916, which
was thinking of a 916.
Yes, right.
Has welded on.
Right.
Roof.
All right, so the 914 GT, now, there was some factory-produced 914 GTs, and then you could actually go to Porsche and buy over-the-counter a kit.
Yeah.
Okay.
The majority of 914-6 GTs were sold as kits.
Oh, okay.
And don't get me wrong, a kit-built 914-6 GT is absolutely as legitimate as a factory-built car.
Okay.
The factory basically either built the cars for their own use, or they built them for, you know, what they'd call friends of the house. And the majority of people that ran 914-6 GTs built them themselves with one of these kits.
Okay. The Brumos car, was that a real GT?
Well, as I say, they're all real.
Oh, okay.
I don't recall. I think Brumos had two cars.
Yeah.
No, that's Ralph Meany. I'm sorry. The Brumos may have just had one.
The orange one? Oh, okay.
Whether they built it themselves or whether they bought a car from Porsche, I don't know. I mean, one theory would be if you've got really good fabricators and you've got a really great race shop, why not buy the kit and do it yourself? Because you can absolutely guarantee that everything is done as good as can humanly be done.
Now, since you've driven both cars, did they both have 2 liters, 2.2s in them, or what kind of engines did they have in them back in the day, the ones you were running?
The 914-6 was homologated by the FIA as a 2-liter car, 1991 cc's.
Okay, and then...
One of the problems that Porsche had in trying to sell 914-6 GTs is that the 911 of that period, I believe, was 2.2 liters. So why would you spend as much money for a 911 on a 914-6 GT that had less power and a smaller motor? So selling 914-6 GTs to racers was a bit of a challenge.
Okay. Well, now, since you've driven both cars, what were the road mannerisms between the two cars? I mean, a lot of people say that the 914 was actually a better balanced car and actually did, had it had more power, would have actually... been a better race car than the 911. How true is that?
Well, one's mid-engine and one's overhung
right
out the back. And you can infer from that the mid-engine configuration is going to be better, and it essentially was. On the other hand, if you're a decent pilot and you can deal with hanging the tail out, there's probably not a second's worth of lap time difference between them, or a tenth of a second worth of lap time difference between them. The motors are the same size and that type of thing.
Okay. Now, well, since I have you here right now, is what would be something that you'd like to share with us a little bit? Pick a topic that you'd kind of want to talk about. I'm always kind of open to that a little bit. I know we were talking about collector cars. Let's talk about how do we get the younger generation involved? Where do you think we're going with this? You know, Monterey's coming up. You know, you've got a number of events coming up. You got Chattanooga, you got the Hilton Head, you've got Audrain coming up.
I think that the issue is that, first of all, I'm not in agreement with the thesis that younger generations aren't interested in cars. I believe that there's a pretty significant cohort of young people who are interested in automobiles, driving automobiles, collecting automobiles, fooling with automobiles, racing automobiles, et cetera, et cetera. What needs to be done is to let them discover the aspects of the automobile that they resonate to in their way. So by thinking you'll solve the problem by having a lower price admission ticket to Pebble Beach isn't going to do anything, because the younger generation of collectors doesn't care about Pebble Beach. What they like is something like Luftgekühlt, which is a pop-up one-day event, and it's much more spontaneous, and they like that a lot better. On the other hand, we've also seen that if you create classes for younger collectors where they can excel, that you get a pretty strong following, which is why Audrain, with their Concours, have a 30 under 30 class, which means that the collector has to be less than 30 years old, and he or she has to have spent less than $30,000 on their show car. And that is a really interesting field, and it has an enormous amount of enthusiasm from the participants. But, you know, things like drifting or tuner cars or, you know, all of those kinds of sort of oddball, as we, the older generation, might look at it, events are things that appeal to the younger generation. Let's see more of that stuff. Personally, I love drifting and tuner cars. I think they're really interesting.
So now, where does the Revs Institute fit into this? Do they have plans to maybe host these type of events in South Florida or elsewhere?
Revs,
yeah,
has a mission and a vision that basically says that Revs wants to be the single most useful resource for the historical and meaningful car community worldwide. That's a big order, but that's where we're headed. We want to basically be the place that you go to for when you're looking for a resource to help you with some issue that you may have with your meaningful or your collectible historical automobile. And whether that's historic background or whether that's technical stuff or what, you know, the areas that we're interested in being part of the conversation is first and foremost care and use protocols, which we call praxis. So we want to be the place you come to for discussion of some of those kinds of things. Then there's connoisseurship, which is all about authenticity, originality, why two relatively similar looking cars, one of which has much higher historical or aesthetic or technological value than the other, those kinds of things. And the idea of legacy, which is about the history of the automobile, where it's been, what it's done, the context that it's been found in, et cetera, et cetera. And then finally, society, which is how do we make the case to people who aren't all that interested in cars that automobiles are one of the most consequential artifacts of human legacy of the 20th century.
Now,
so, you know, it's a broad variety of things that we're interested in.
Okay, now I'm going to say this and then correct me, okay? So let's just use SVRA as an example. So SVRA, 1972 is the cutoff for true vintage cars, provided they have, you know, racing history and everything like that. So when you're talking Revs Institute, history, legacy, what year, is there a year cutoff? Is there, what are we talking about there? So is there an era?
We roll forward with the years.
Okay.
You know, the cars that Revs collects has nothing to do with the idea that Revs wants to be a resource for the historical car community. Because, you know, every year that goes by, you get one more graduating class of historical cars that go from being, you know, modern to being historical.
Okay.
And understand that what I said was the historical and meaningful car community. What the heck's a meaningful car? A meaningful car is a car that's meaningful to its owner. Doesn't have to be meaningful to anybody else. But we're interested in helping people who are interested in engaging with the automobiles and automobile communities around cars of any given year and type, because we think that it's one of the great community building vehicles that are out there in the world. And people today, especially younger people, are not exposed to the material world to the extent that they should be. People don't know, you know, nobody knows how to repair a toaster. I mean, what's going on? And the car, the automobile, is such a great device to educate people, to expose them to the principles of the material world. Because if you tune your car wrong, it doesn't run right. It doesn't care what you think. It doesn't care whether you're a good person or a bad person. It only cares whether you know how to do that. And that's a useful lesson for people, I think.
Would it be fair to say that, you know, and, I mean, I know when I grew up and I was in high school in the 70s, we had shop class, we had wood shop, we had electronics, we had drafting, we had automotive.
It's great stuff, and it's no longer available, or it's very rarely available.
Yeah, so is there, like, an organization like REVS or, you know, some of the other museums that are out there, I'm kind of like, I don't want to say shocked or stunned, but I'm surprised that we're not having any influence in the schools to bring back vocation, because not everybody's a college kid, okay? And a lot of people, like you said, like to work with their hands. They like to, there's this sense of gratification when you build something, when you fix something, when you create something, and that's also part of the philosophy behind the REVS Institute.
No, absolutely, and that's an area that the REVS Institute is really interested in, trying to make some progress. For example, at the moment, we have a wholly owned subsidiary of the REVS Institute, not for profit, called REVS Ed. And REVS Ed is all about teaching people, male and female, old and young, say starting at around age 10, going up to as old as you want to contemplate, on how to work on old school cars. And we have a whole series of classes that take you through how to tune an old school car, how to troubleshoot it, how to work on the brakes, how the suspension works, and how to adjust that, how the electrical systems work, and even elementary and soon to be introduced more advanced methods of metal shaping and forming so that you can start making stuff so you can get involved with your car.
One of the schools that comes to mind is the McPherson School.
Yeah, McPherson College in McPherson, Kansas.
Yeah, yeah. Now, do you reciprocate with them? Do you share any duties, responsibilities, or, you know, kind of like coordinate with them, correspond with them from the standpoint that some of their students can come visit the REVS Institute, you know, pick up some information, knowledge, interact with some of your restoration people or staff or anything like that? Or how does that work?
We have for years, because my curator, Scott George, is an advisor to the auto restoration major at McPherson College. We have for years had a McPherson student as a summer intern. And some of them have gone on to get jobs with us. So, you know, we have a good relationship with McPherson. We are talking to them as we are with a number of other automobile institutions that have substantial automotive libraries about how we can share the back offices and thereby reduce our costs and yet still maintain control over the management of our own archives and libraries. And I think that will be a valuable initiative to move forward. And unlike McPherson, what REVS is really focused on is not teaching the principles of automotive maintenance and interaction as a vocation, but to do it as a avocation and as a way to teach people about the material world. So there's a significant difference between what we want to do and what an academic program like McPherson is trying to do. I'm going for a bigger market where we'd like to have some kind of a relationship with the school system in the Naples area, where we working with the schools, can deliver a STEM-based program around the automobile.
That's where I was going with this. Excellent, excellent. Now, Miles, we got about a minute and a half left, or maybe more, but let's just call it a minute. Is there any car that you would like to have in your collection that has eluded you for years and years and years that you have this quest, this passion to find?
Well, you know, I don't know that there's any one car. I mean, I've had cars that have gotten away that I have regretted. And I have sort of a list in the back of my head of a lot of wonderful cars.
Right.
But if I'm going to pull one out of the air, I don't know why I'm grabbing this one, but I am. How about an Aston Martin DB4 GT Zagato?
Oh, okay. Very nice selection.
DB4 GT Zagato. They're a beautiful-looking car. And to me, while they're not probably quite as fast as the Ferrari 250 short wheelbase Berlinetta, they are considerably rarer, and they're just so sexy.
Now, does the 64 Zagato GT look like the 60-61 body style, or is it different?
The Aston Martin DB4 GT looks like a typical Aston Martin DB4.
Right, right.
Okay. The GTZ has a very typical Zagato style, much more streamlined, jelly bean shaped coachwork.
Uh-huh.
You look at the car and it's very Italian.
Oh, yes, no question. By the way, speaking of which, do you go to the Concorso Italiano when you're in Monterey?
I haven't of recent years because I'm usually so busy with other things, but uh-huh. That's a really good good event.
Yeah, well,
if you want to see cool Italian stuff, that's a place to go for sure.
No question about that. Well, Miles, we're about ready to drop the Trekker flag here again, so they're going to wave us in. So at any rate, I want to thank you for hanging out with us. I'll tell you what I'd like to do. Down the road, maybe after Audrain or someplace down the road, I'll come up with some more ideas. I'll probably bump into you here and there. And then I'd love to have you on again from time to time to just kind of be, fill us in as what's going on and shed some light as to, what's happening in our industry, because there's a whole bunch of other things that we could have talked about, the collector car world and some of your favorite cars that you've driven over the years, and just a number of things, what the entire Revs Institute's all about, obviously, and the Collier collection. So
very well, thank you.
So again, I want to thank you very much for hanging out with us, and perhaps I'll see you next week in Monterey.
Sure you will.
All right,
see you then.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank my very special guest Miles Collier of the Revs Institute and the Collier collection down in Naples, Florida, for hanging out with us here at Nostalgic Radio and Cars. And, Bob, you've done a fine job. Again, like I said, a big shout-out to all my friends and all my usual listeners. And I'm looking forward to going down there. What am I talking about here? How much time we got, Bobby? You got a minute or so?
We got one minute.
One minute? Okay. So, anyway, like I said, Monterey Collector Car Week's coming up. Google Monterey Collector Car Week's. Look at all the events and stuff like that that's going on. It's really, really neat. Again, in the fall, we got the, I went to this last year. It was up in Rhode Island, Newport, Rhode Island, the Audrain Concourse. It was very, very nice. It's actually out on the Vanderbilt Estate, overlooks the Atlantic Ocean. It's absolutely stunning. Obviously, Donald Osborne was up there, good friend of mine. He's been on our show a lot. Jay Leno was up there. A number of people are up there. They've got seminars, symposiums, auctions. Bottoms, I think, is up there. An amazing car collection, amazing display of cars on the concourse. Showfield on Sunday. Are we running out of time, Bobby? Okay. Well, anyway, hey, this is Nostalgic Radio Cars. Don't forget to check us out here every Tuesday between 7 and 8 p.m. on the Tantalk Radio Network. Tell your friends, follow us on social media. Get out there and drive your cars. Stay safe, drive carefully, and love your family.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
Listen.